you know, it's an example of a law that doesn't come up all the time, that's I've spoken about quite extensively in the news, called the Slayer Statute. And the Slayer Statute says, for, you know, good reason, if you have intentionally killed another person, you are going to be prohibited from inheriting from the person you murdered.
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting through divorce with financial consulting and strategy.
Hey guys, you know what's the best way to get in touch with your friends? Sharing an episode of the Click Line podcast. So don't forget to like, subscribe, and share the episodes, and let me know what you think in the comments.
Welcome to today's episode of the Click Line podcast. We have a very special guest today, Sean Weisbart. He is a partner at Blank Rome, which has over 800 attorneys and 16 offices globally. He is co-chair of the Tax Benefits and Private Client Practice Group. His practice focuses on trusts and estates, as well as tax-exempt organizations. He also represents clients on matrimonial matters, including the negotiation of prenup and postnup and trust modifications following divorce. In addition to his law practice, Sean also serves as an adjunct professor of law at NYU School of Law. And as one of the most highly regarded millennial estate planners in the country, you may have seen him go viral on his commentary about the Nick Reiner case on Entertainment Tonight, People Magazine. Just Google him and you'll find it. We are so lucky to have you here today, Sean. Welcome to the Click Line podcast.
Thank you, Mina. It is so wonderful to be here, and I really appreciate that warm introduction.
Yes, if you need me in any intros going forward, let me know. You know, what's interesting, Sean, I know you're based in New York and I'm in California. And as we talk about trusts and, you know, building out trusts, I think it's also important to note, you know, differences in various states. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
So every state in this country has its own laws. Not to pretend to be a constitutional lawyer, but our 10th Amendment says that states get to regulate their own laws unless the federal government has come up with those laws. And so as a result, every state has different rules about trusts, and every state has different rules about property and how property could be titled, especially when you're married. And so as a result, depending on what state you're in, the trust laws might be very, very different. It might be helpful to highlight two really key distinctions that I think are most common. There are a handful of states in this country that are sort of trust haven states. They're the states where probably the majority of sophisticated trusts are established. They may not actually be the states that have the largest populations. For example, they're probably Delaware, Nevada, South Dakota, Alaska, and Wyoming. And although I don't have the population of this country in front of me, I think it's safe to assume that those are not the most populous states in the country. Yet they have laws that for various reasons, people want to flock to those states to have the laws of that state govern those trusts. In some examples, trusts under those states, the trust can last forever. So if you're a very, very wealthy person, you can have a trust that's established dynastically for generations and generations to come, which you may not be able to do in your home state, which may say a trust has to terminate within 100 years. They also have a lot of creditor protection. So in some of these states, someone can actually protect their assets from creditors, even if they remain a beneficiary of a trust. So they can put their assets into a trust that benefits them. And if they ever have a creditor issue, those assets, at least under the laws of that state, will be protected from creditors. So that's one of the two key issues I wanted to flag in terms of the differences among the states. The second thing is property. And so Mina, you being in California, myself being in New York, this is the classic example. California is the most common of the minority of states that when you're married, titles property as what's called community property. And New York is one of the majority of states that does not use community property. Instead, we call it the title approach to property. What does that mean in real English? So in a community property state, property that's acquired during the marriage is generally deemed to be owned by the community, owned equally by each spouse. It could be that you go out to work and you're getting your paycheck, but those earnings are actually earnings of the community. And so if you're going to give them away to a trust, you are not actually the one who's making the gift only. It would be you and your spouse, because the way that property is owned, because of the virtue of the fact that you're married, it's owned by the community. In the majority of states, like the one I'm in New York, property is governed by title. So you go out to work, you earn that money is titled in your name. And so if you want to give it away to a trust, you don't need your spouse's permission to do that. Now, I should point out a common misconception. Just because it's titled in your own name doesn't mean you'd get to keep it if there is a divorce, right? That property in a divorce may be reachable by your spouse. But in an intact marriage, if the property is in a title state like New York, you can transfer it to a trust and you do not need your spouse's permission.
Got it. Okay. And what about, how would people differentiate between, should I get a will, just have a will in place, or do I have to have a trust in place?
Sure.
To guide your clients.
Absolutely. So when we think about wills and trusts, we're probably thinking about a will in something called a living revocable trust. A living revocable trust is one type of trust that's commonly used in association with a will. And so when you just have a will will dispose of the assets you own at the time you die in however you direct in that will. One of the downsides to just having a will is that when you die, whoever you name as your executor has to go to court to probate that will, so that the court says, yes, executor, you can take title to the decedent, the deceased person's property, and then distribute it out in accordance with the terms of the will. If instead of a will, you use what's called a living revocable trust, you can avoid having to go to court and all of the costs and time associated with that process. How do you do it? While you're alive, you transfer your property to that trust. You haven't really given anything away, because while you're alive, you're the only beneficiary of the trust. You're the only trustee. What's the difference? The difference is at the time you die, you no longer own those assets. Your trust owns those assets. And as a result, you don't have to go to probate because you don't own anything. The trust owns something, and you appoint a successor trustee who becomes the trustee the moment you die, who then is able, without court intervention, to distribute out all of your property in the same way as a will, but without any of the costs and any of the headache of probate. Your question, Mina, was how do I educate clients on what's the right approach? Well, again, it varies state by state. California, probate's very, very difficult. New York, probate less difficult in certain situations. If it's a nuclear family where everyone's happy, everyone's treated equally, probate's less of a big deal in a state like New York, just because the process is fairly simple. So we'd look at what state does someone live in, who are their family members that might be notified as part of the probate process, are they treating people equally? Depending on what state they're in, if they're in California, we're likely going to tell them, you should have a revocable trust regardless. If there are in other states, it may be dependent on how simple their plan is, whether they're treating their children equally or unequally, or whether they have distant cousins or other family members who might need to be notified as part of the probate process. It's a great question, and it's front and center of everything we do.
Yeah, and so to give people an idea, how long could a probate process take, and what are the costs? Because I've heard in the tens of thousands in court fees.
So the legal fees for a probate could certainly climb into the tens of thousands. There are cases where it's hundreds of thousands. It depends on a number of factors. First of all, what state you're in, but primarily the complexity of the assets. If what would make something more complicated? If the decedent had assets in multiple countries, if they're family members who live outside of the United States who might need to be notified, if there are liens on certain assets that need to be transferred, if the decedent had creditors who come forward and want to bring a claim, if there's a dispute among family members, perhaps the will is unclear, perhaps there was some outstanding promise or obligation that existed that needs to be resolved. All of those things come up after someone dies and can result in the fees climbing into that scary amount.
And so when you're thinking about assigning a trustee, it's kind of a unique situation because one is obviously someone you have to trust, but also thinking about whether or not this person will still be around, you know, when you need them to be. How do you walk clients through, you know, trying to decide who to put in this trustee position?
Sure. So the first thing I ask clients when they tell me who the name of their trustee is going to be is, how old is this person? And when they tell me that that person is around their age or older, I say, that's a great first choice, but we're going to need to come up with some younger successors or perhaps an institution. Because a trustee is only as good as the trustee outliving you and being around for a long time to come, either to complete the probate process or in certain situations to administer trusts for children or other family members for many, many years to come. And so it's really important that you can identify younger family members, younger close friends who are certainly financially savvy, or if not, thinking about a professional, whether it's an accountant, a lawyer, a bank, or a trust company that will certainly be around for a long time to come.
Great. Yeah, that's a great idea. Have you ever had an instance where a trustee has abused their position and had to get involved?
Yes. So there is a whole procedure in the law of every state where a beneficiary can challenge the actions of a trustee. And I would break it up really into two different buckets, right? There are situations where a beneficiary doesn't like how the trustee is administering the trust, but it doesn't rise to the level of warranting legal action. And then there are the really unfortunate situations where a beneficiary actually has a cause of action against the trustee. In the former situation, if a beneficiary doesn't like how the trust is being administered, my job when I'm setting up trusts, right, is to have conversations with my client, right, the person who's setting up the trust, and saying, hey, what police powers do you want your beneficiaries to have over this trust? What if they just don't like how the trust is being administered? What if the trustee is not being generous enough to them? What if the trustee is making conservative investment choices that are inconsistent with the growth they want to see in the trust? The answer is they can give their beneficiary the power to remove and replace trustees, or they can give some independent people the power to remove and replace trustees, just if that person believes that the trust is not being administered in the way that they want. Now, the second issue is, what if those powers don't exist, or even if those powers do exist, and the beneficiary says, you know what, the trustee has really done stuff that's cost me money, that's been abusive, that may have resulted in their own financial gain at my expense. Then there is going to be court involvement where the trustee could really be punished and risk very serious financial penalties.
Okay, got it. And so is there ever a time where an asset should not go into a trust?
Absolutely. So one of the complexities of setting up a trust is identifying what assets belong in it. And so generally, when we're thinking about revocable trusts, those were the types of trusts we just spoke about that are substitutes for wills. Pretty much you can put anything in that trust, right? As long as you own it, it's going to be fine to put it in the trust. But there's another type of trust, an irrevocable trust, where you really have to be very careful about the type of asset you transfer to that trust. People set up irrevocable trusts because they want to make gifts to loved family members or friends, and they don't want to give it to them outright. They want to put it in a trust so someone else is managing it. That could be for tax benefits, for creditor reasons, because the beneficiaries have spending issues. And so the asset that goes into that trust is really, really important. The number one thing is it has to be an asset that the person who's making the transfer does not need to use anymore. Because if that asset is in an irrevocable trust, they're not going to have the level of access that they had to it while they're alive. And that means they're not going to benefit from the income. They may not be able to leverage it for spending purposes or doing other projects. You see this with business owners. They may want to leverage assets. All of that becomes much more challenging once the asset is inside of a trust.
Got it. Okay. So would you recommend like business owners to keep a revocable trust then and have the business, would the business be listed in that?
Your business certainly could be in the revocable trust because it would help avoid probate. That depends, right? It depends on what's supposed to happen to the person's interest in the business when they die. Maybe there's going to be a buyout. Maybe it's going to go to the family. So it would make sense potentially to put a business in a revocable trust. There are times it makes sense to put a business in an irrevocable trust. But if it's in an irrevocable trust and that business sells, the trust is going to get its share of the sale proceeds, not the business owner.
Right. Okay. Those are, it's a great distinction and important to note. Now, what about families with kids and if they have a guardian that's separate from a trustee? Should it be different people? Should it be the same person? Who will have oversight over the guardian? Can you go into that a little bit?
It's such an incredibly good question, and it's a question that touches so many people who are young parents. And, you know, I'll share that the catalyst for many people to first start thinking about estate planning is when that child is born, right? And why? Well, the way that you appoint a guardian for a child is through a will. And so once you're doing a will, now you're thinking about all these issues that we've spoken about and many, many more. Now, when it comes to children, we're thinking about, should the same person be the guardian of the child, who would also be the trustee of the child, maybe the executor of the will? All the various hats that need to be filled when I'm doing my job. And the answer is it depends. This is the decision that many, many parents struggle with. And both parents really have to have a meeting of the minds, because if it's a child, right, both parents should have an equal say in who the guardian is going to be. And if they disagree, you're sort of playing roulette, because believe it or not, if you disagreed, it would be the will of the parent who died second that would govern, not necessarily. So there could be this sort of like you're playing kind of a game, right, as to who's to die second. But when people agree, which is what we like, it depends, because a lot of people struggle with who real name, right? Not everyone has a sibling who they trust. People may trust their parents, but we already addressed age as a huge factor. The parents may be too old. They may or may not have close friends. And so depending on how many trusted people are in their life may dictate whether they even have the luxury of spreading these roles out. If they do, it's common for people to say, you know what, let me have a different guardian from trustee, because that way there's a de facto system of checks and balances on the two people who have authority on, you know, managing the children's livelihood and then managing the children's money. So it's common to do it that way when people really have the luxury of a number of people in their life who they really trust. But I'll share with you that not everyone has that.
Right. Yeah. And that has to be a difficult decision too, to have both people in place that you can trust and will outlive you. So it's
absolutely,
you must have to have like at least five people listed or something, because you never know what's going
to happen. There are times I have five, there are times I have 10. And then what we really get into is, let's say you name someone who's married. Do you want that person's spouse to take over if that person ceases to serve? And then we get into details only if they're happily married at the time the first person ceased to serve. And we get into such weeds on this. It's really fascinating for something that's unlikely to happen.
Right, right. And so what about for digital assets? Are you seeing that more and more, like crypto being included in these trusts?
So our estate planning documents address digital assets, of which crypto is one, but actually the digital asset that almost everyone has is social media. Billions of people use social media, and social media is a digital asset. And we have provisions in our wills, our powers of attorney, that give the executor or the agent under the power of attorney access to a decedent or the principal's digital assets if they're needed for purposes of administering the estate. Now, this is something that I think very, very carefully about, and I really like to point out for people, especially in the context of digital assets like email and social media. I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of people say, yeah, I have no problem. Give my executor access to my Instagram, my email, etc. And by the way, why it's not just so that they can continue posting, right? It's actually, if you think about it, and some people do create these legacy pages, which I'm sure we've all seen, and maybe that's why people do it. But the reason the law even regulates this issue is oftentimes when someone dies, you don't even know where their assets are. And so access to digital assets, whether it's email or social media, can actually help an executor figure out, oh, wait, this person was getting emails every month from this bank or this financial institution. Let me look there to discover their property, right?
Right.
Now, of course, for some people, they are very grateful that I point out this power. And they say, you know, Sean, would you please take that out? Because some people may not want their spouse or their children going through their emails. I don't need to say why. We all hear stories about what goes on in people's lives. So there just may be stuff that they want to keep private and die with.
Yeah, like going to a Coldplay concert or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Or whatever happened at Stagecoach should stay at Stagecoach.
Right. But, okay, so hypothetically, if they don't have a password for Gmail and they're trying to gain access to an account, do you have to go to court to try to gain access to that account?
So this is also a great question. So as you mentioned right when we started, every state really has different rules. And this is also a situation that the states can have various rules. However, in this situation, there is something called RUFADA. That's an acronym for a act that relates to digital assets that was passed a number of years ago that's been adopted by many, many states. So when a will is silent on giving an executor access to someone's email or digital assets, there's a system that many states have adopted that allows the executor to go to court and gain only certain access to digital assets. What you can't get is the content of the emails, but you can get a list of who of the emails received by the decedent, and so that you can see who was contacting them, because that way you are sort of balancing the privacy aspect with not looking through the content of someone's emails, but still gaining access to see, you know, what may be out there in terms of assets that so having limited access to digital assets may be necessary. It's a really interesting area.
Okay. Interesting. And so I briefly wanted to touch on the Nick Reiner case as well, and wanted to get your thoughts on this situation.
Well, first, what an incredibly sad story. And as a family dynamic, I mean, Nick's siblings, my heart just goes out to them because they're caught in this awful situation between having lost their parents and their brother being accused of killing them. But I imagine they must love their brother so much and feel that, I know that it's public in the media about the troubles that he had gone through during his life. And, you know, it's an example of a law that doesn't come up all the time, but that's I've spoken about quite extensively in the news, called the Slayer Statute. And the Slayer Statute says, for, you know, good reason, if you have intentionally killed another person, you are going to be prohibited from inheriting from the person you murdered. And if Nick Reiner is convicted of killing his parents, he will not inherit from them.
Right. And so is the Slayer Statute in all of the states, or is it California specific?
So each state would have its own Slayer Statute. California has a specific Slayer Statute that's in its probate code. There are some distinctions between the various states, and I'm happy to speak about it. But yeah, it's a common statute in all states with different distinctions, or common law.
Got it. Okay. And so what if he is not guilty by reason of like mental insanity?
Sure.
What happens then?
I think that's Nick's best shot at inheriting, because the Slayer Statute says that for it to apply in California, you have to have feloniously and intentionally killed someone. And if someone is acquitted by reason of insanity, although they still may have killed this person, right? And the Slayer statue does not require a criminal conviction. We should talk about that too. But if you don't have the mental state, right, to have been convicted of murder because you are declared to be insane based on whatever needs to be proven for not guilty by reason of insanity, it is unlikely to me that you would have the mental state, or we probably hear this term mens rea, right? Like the criminal state of mind to have actually committed murder in a way that is required to have feloniously and intentionally killed someone for the Slayer statue to apply.
That's interesting. And then what if there's drugs or possibility of drugs, legal and illegal drugs, that's combined into that? How does that affect the Slayer statute?
So again, the Slayer statute requires that you have to have feloniously and intentionally killed someone. And if your state of mind was such that you did not have that intention, there's an argument that the Slayer statute would not apply. I can't see how it would apply if someone is convicted of first-degree murder, intentional homicide. But in other situations where someone may be convicted of something lesser, or where they may be acquitted by reason of insanity, I think there's an argument that the Slayer statute would not apply. And these are rare cases.
Right. And so, I mean, we don't know what the trust or will or any of that looks like, but is it possible for the trustee to be denying funds for his legal team?
Absolutely. I think the trustee should be doing that. The question is, who's the trustee? And what I've been thinking about this, and I wonder if any of Nick's siblings are in charge. And talk about a situation where there would be between a rock and a hard place. Now, if Nick has money in his own pocket, even money that was gifted to him outright from his parents, he can use that to pay his fees. But how else might Nick be affording his counsel? And one of the things I thought of is, are the siblings who may have access to some funds right now, we don't know, are they giving Nick this money? Now, if the Slayer statue does ultimately apply, anything that they've given him, I think, is a gift. Now, just because someone commits murder, the Slayer statute precludes them from inheriting, that doesn't mean that someone else who inherited couldn't gift them money. But I think that his siblings in that situation, if you look at it, would actually have made a gift because Nick would have lost any rights he had to his parents' property. So there could be gift tax consequences if we think this through.
Interesting. I did see that his attorney stepped away from the case. What are some possible reasons for that besides maybe not getting paid?
It could be that whoever's advising Nick is looking in a different direction. It could be that there are concerns about getting paid. I doubt there's a conflict, or he wouldn't have started in the first place. But it's hard to really speculate as to what the reason is.
Got it. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. And so, as you know, the name of the podcast is the Click Line Podcast. And so I always like to ask, what moment in your personal or professional life did something all of a sudden click for you?
Well, I started my career as a litigator, doing something very, very different than I do right now. And I did that for about 3.5 years. And then I switched into doing trust and estates. And I think that was a click for me because I felt that, you know, as a lawyer, we have this obligation, I think, at least I feel this way, this moral obligation to help people. And I take such pride in my ability every single day to deal with human beings and talking to them about things that are so deeply personal to them, their family, the secrets that they have, their money, their assets, what are the best ways of giving it away, and who should be the custodians of that. And for me, that clicked because, you know, we go to work every single day, and what a blessing it is to be able to sit across from people who share their life with you, share their values with you, and look to you to help them create legacies that will last for many, many years to come. So that was a real click moment for me when I figured out exactly what I wanted to do as a lawyer. And it's been 15 years or so.
Wow, that's amazing. And it is an awesome legacy for you to leave too, being able to help people create legacies. And you you know, customizing their unique family needs and seeing that on for generations. So amazing work, Sean. Thank you so much. And being on the Click Line, I hope to see you soon. And so thank you again. I know you're super busy.
Thank you, Mina. It was such a pleasure to spend some time with you, and thank you for having me.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.